Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Lauren Templeton, the founder and president of Templeton & Phillips Capital Management, a value investing boutique located in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Lauren has shared her wisdom and ideas with our community in the past, and I'm very grateful that she could be here today to share her perspective in this quite a unique moment in market history. And I understand that Scott Phillips may jump in as well, perhaps later on the call. So Lauren, I would like to now just turn it to you for your remarks in this period, and then we will have a Q&A afterwards.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for having me join you today. It's a pleasure. And obviously, before we begin, I just want to acknowledge that the circumstances surrounding this panic do pose a serious health concern. And I'm very sensitive to those affected. Scott and I are praying for those affected, and we have deep admiration for the courageous healthcare professionals serving on the front lines, as they are our real heroes today. From an investment standpoint, though, we have very clear obligations to our clients that we maintain the focus on their investment portfolios, which in many cases represent their financial livelihoods. In that regard, the panic surrounding COVID-19 represents a critical opportunity to stay focused, and as my uncle John Templeton used to say, accommodate the sellers. So, as many of you know, my husband and I co-authored a book many years ago. It's been published into 9 languages now, and it is called Investing the Templeton Way. We actually wrote the majority of it on our honeymoon, so there's some funny memories surrounding that. But in the book, we spent most of the time discussing the psychological aspects of investing. And in particular, my uncle John Templeton's enormous aptitude for making wise investments during the most critical points of distress in the markets, which he always referred to as points of maximum pessimism. So if you may remember, he's famous for saying, "Bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy, and the time of maximum optimism is the best time to sell." So obviously right now we're closer to the point of maximum pessimism than we were a month ago. And for those of you listening, we believe there are really three components to buying at the point of maximum pessimism. The first are psychological, second, physiological, and three, the application. So one of the quotes that I often remind myself of during these moments of maximum pessimism is another quote from my uncle, and he said, "To buy when others are despondently selling and to sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest ultimate rewards." So how do you have great fortitude? Well, mental fortitude comes from firsthand knowledge. At our company, we believe it's very important to investigate our ideas ourselves and not rely on street research. Doing your own investigation and research really allows you to build what I call a mental fortress. So many people in today's market are relying on social proofing. And social proofing may be acceptable in areas of life outside of investing, but it really leads to disastrous results as an investor. So social proofing might be very important with the COVID-19 pandemic. It's important to stay inside. It's important not to expose yourself to germs. But things are different in the markets, and social proofing rarely leads to good results. So investors relying on secondhand information are often crippled by uncertainty, when the financial and economic environments suddenly change, and they have no confidence in their underlying holdings. In the past, the market was starved for information. But today, and I'm sitting here watching Bloomberg News, today the market faces a daily deluge of information. Unfortunately, most of it is still derived from the same secondhand sources that undermine thoughtful behavior. And really, COVID-19 has been no exception. In January and February, when we were first getting first reports out of China on COVID-19, we observed consistent discrepancies between media reports on economic conditions in China and what we were finding through our own research efforts with people who were over in China, running businesses, boots on the ground. We were getting very conflicting information than what was reported in the media. So the effects of the secondhand information is only compounded by market conditions today. Studies show that as much as two-thirds of the market's trading volume is driven by algorithms. I'm sure some of your guests have discussed this on previous podcasts. So these algorithms, as you know, scour Twitter and internet media headlines with a simple mission of acting first. The information driving this activity is often questionably sourced and in some cases even manipulated to stimulate this activity in a desired direction. And the other thing that I want to point out that I think is contributing to the market panic today is that the human traders left on Wall Street have an average age of 30 years old. These guys were in high school during the great financial crisis. And they have only seen bull markets that have spanned the entirety of their careers. Through no fault of their own, their experience does not equip them to deal with this bear market. And our research suggests that the average person spends one-third of their life in bear markets. This is, you know, part of that one-third. You have to get really comfortable and not panic in these situations because they are a staple to financial markets. I often tell organizations that I work with, nonprofits, when they're trying to think about how to manage their endowments, to go ahead and plan for a 50% correction. They do come along. This is not the first time this has happened. It's a little bit unlike other times, but they do come along, and certainly bear markets are common. So lastly, 11 years and counting into this zero interest rate environment, there's predictably too much leverage in our system, which has only exacerbated market movements even more. So with all that said, I think the pressure facing investors to buy right now at the point of maximum pessimism has probably never been greater. In terms of how we're applying buying at the point of maximum pessimism at Templeton & Phillips Capital Management today, we're approaching it from a bottoms-up perspective. So these points of maximum pessimism can vary widely and have in my career. Terrorist attacks, financial crises, and, you know, now we can add pandemics to the list of points of maximum pessimism that I have experienced. I guess, you know, this is different than H1N1, but my first child was born on March 10th of 2009. The low was reached in the market on March 9th, 2009. I remember Scott and I going on CNBC late that spring and on Power Lunch, I think, or one of these shows. And I said, you know, I think my daughter's ushering in the next big bull market. And people kind of laughed about that. But boy, did she ever. you know, she ushered in a great bull market. But also during that time period, we had the H1N1 panic. And I can remember being very worried about traveling with my daughter. At the same time, we were taking advantage of that panic in our investment offices, and we had really zeroed in on Mexican airport operators. So we're used to playing these panics. Now, granted, this is a very large one. They're all different, but the same components are involved in all these market events. Same market behavior, because it's human behavior. So our approach to buying in the COVID-19 pandemic is not much different than our behavior placing orders on the behalf of my Uncle John following the market's reopening after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. I can remember I had launched my first fund in June of 2001. So I was pretty new and inexperienced during the terrorist attacks. But I remember that he contacted me and told me that the airline stocks would fall too much when the exchanges reopen. And he instructed me to research the airlines with the safest balance sheets. And I reiterate, the safest balance sheets. And then place limit orders to buy any that fell more than 50% during the first trading session when markets reopened. And we were filled on three of those orders, and all three of them produced great, enormous returns, as he correctly had wagered that the U.S. government would not allow them to fail. And we have a chapter in Investing the Templeton Way dedicated to this trade. And I have to say, in today's market, it's probably worth a read. So in the past few weeks, what have we been doing? We've been following the same principles. We've been buying what we believe are attractive bargains with clean balance sheets at the height of the panic. What makes this event most rewarding, though, is the opportunity to choose from a wide range of inventory that is not normally available to value investors. And growth and quality rarely land in the value camp, as you know, except during periods of extreme duress. So we are careful to look for bargains in areas that are rarely available. So I don't really want to discuss all of our holdings for a number of reasons, but I will tell you that we have purchased Amazon for the first time. Amazon traded down to 14.9 times cash flow on March 12th, a multiple that is slightly lower than its previous low set in November of 2008. The firm has a clean balance sheet and a growth runway for years to come. I know that most of you are familiar with the firm, so there's really not a need for me to repeat what you already know. However, we cannot help but be amazed that its valuation touched a low when it is actually gaining business in this post-COVID world. We have been careful to think about the long term and how certain secular trends are being reinforced by this event. And the current opportunities in the digital economy and with the emerging market consumer are huge priorities for us, as well as the chance for quality firms to take market share in this changing funding environment. So with that being said, you know, the global pandemic created by COVID-19 is a serious matter. It gives rise to legitimate health and economic concerns. But still, COVID-19 is going to come and go. It's going to leave a mark, but it will come and go. I have Scott with me now, and he can jump in on some of these points as I go through a list of bullet points that I have made that I think will be very helpful to your listeners. And then we can conclude with some Q&A. Is that okay with you? Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, please.
Okay. So firstly, we like this market. We have been purchasing stocks during the past few weeks. We like it. We're buyers. From a valuation standpoint, the sell-off has been dramatic enough to temporarily price some really outstanding businesses near their 2008 valuation levels. If you look at the equity risk premium as a proxy, it touched 6.8%. That is above 2008 and 2009 levels. It did this around March, between March 9th and March 12th or something like that. We believe this in part is owed to algorithmic trading comprising two-thirds of the market, as I said earlier. And also the average age of Wall Street traders being 30 years old, we think they're really not psychologically equipped to handle this bear market. As well as marginal buyers and sellers are in ETFs, which created enormous correlation across equities due to the indiscriminate selling that we have seen. And finally, a decade of low rates has led to high leverage and margin calls, which it really creates the perfect storm for bargain hunting. The key in our minds is the ability to make wise long-term purchases during heightened panics. And our focus has consistently been on secular growth and clean balance sheets. We are particularly focused on free cash flow yield. So free cash flow yield has been a dominant alpha factor during the past 20 years, with a particular outperformance during the past 5 years. During the past 22 years, free cash flow yield has produced 8.3% of alpha annualized versus 4.4% in low PE stocks. And during the past 5 years, 3.7% versus 0.8% in low PE stocks. So I think that's really important to point out. We have used this opportunity to purchase new stocks with these attributes. As I mentioned before, we bought Amazon. We believe we are now in a challenging balance sheet environment and that the market is finally aware of long-standing excesses in the corporate sector. We believe that firms with competitive advantages and strong balance sheets are set to outperform in this environment. So during the past three recessions, the top quartile firms by sector returned a positive 6%, while the bottom quartile returned a negative 44%. With that said, we feel super fortunate to have been able to add to our quality holdings in the sell-off. And we are feeling very optimistic regarding their ability to gain market share in years to come. Our emphasis from a fundamental standpoint has been on the digital economy and the emerging market consumer, since we believe that COVID will actually accelerate trends in the digital economy. I mean, right now, as we speak, I think a lot of your listeners will know that I live in a remote area in Tennessee in a small town on a mountaintop. And our office is about a mile from our house. But right now, as we speak, you know, I've got kids at home doing Zoom meetings. They are actively participating in distance learning. They're in first and fifth grade. They're having video chats with their friends. They're doing video, you know, book clubs, art classes, meeting with their teachers. I think it's also funny that my father, who is a total, total technophobe, but loves to invest, and even more than investing, loves to save money. He is, for the first time, he is talking about requiring that all of his meetings occur on Zoom going forward because it's a more economical way to host meetings and saves time and money. He doesn't need to travel anymore, he says. So I think, you know, that's pretty funny. What's next for him? An iPhone? I doubt it, but he's definitely enjoying the Zoom meetings that he is participating in. He is, you know, one of the individuals that I learned the art of investing from. And a few years ago, we were in Canada together. I guess we won't be traveling anymore together, but we were in Canada together. And I grew up in this household where the people said, no market timing. You cannot time the market. Do not try to time the market. The time to invest is when you have the capital. You've got to make two decisions right if you market time, when to get out and when to get back in. People are incapable of doing this. But a few years ago, my husband and I were in Canada with Dad, and he said that he was going to 50% cash. And I almost started crying, and I immediately asked him, I said, are you dying? And he said, no, I'm not dying. Your mother and I are just, you know, we've gotten older. We've lived through, you know, many different panics and crises events. I don't want to worry about it. I'm going to 50% cash. Well, over the years, his cash position had crept up to 90, 95%. And he missed out on a lot of this market. And he stood pat. He did not get greedy. And he's in a great position now. He's actually very excited about the prospects of his cash at the moment. So thus far at our company, we've really resisted making any purchases in the distressed categories, you know, airlines, tourism, et cetera. Although we fully acknowledge that there are smart trades in oil and cruise ships, airlines, hotels, all of that. We're just taking a pass right now. So we like the prospects for future investments in damaged credit even better than today's panic. We will be more patient, and we will wait for credit defaults to spike in earnest and a full-blown recession to begin before we take advantage of those areas. I think that's, you know, kind of important. We have a history of buying cyclicals in a recession. A funny memory that I have is that in 2012, I was speaking at a value investing conference in Omaha, Nebraska. And I remember it was 2012 because I was pregnant with my second child, and I was wearing these wristbands called C-bands because I was so nauseous while I was speaking. But I stood up in front of a room of value investors, I mean, hundreds of them. And I, you know, pitched ArcelorMittal and said that that was my favorite stock pick. And literally people were rolling their eyes. There was a rumble in the room. I don't think anybody actually booed me, but it kind of was a polite way of booing me. I mean, there was no tolerance for this recommendation in the room of seasoned value investment managers. So I don't know if you remember that time period, but that was right on the heels of the European debt crisis. ArcelorMittal is a beaten down steel stock. It had a good amount of debt. It was selling off assets to pay down debt. No growth in sight for the company, and it was selling at 1/4 book value. And it turned out to be one of the greatest investments we've ever made at this company. So we like to buy cyclicals in a recession. So that's just, I don't know, a funny story I thought I would mention. One thing that we do have our eye on is that in the S&P 500, goodwill sits at a record $3.6 trillion. So in 2000, 2001, and then during the great financial crisis, goodwill write-downs, as you know, pressured low-quality stocks. So that's something we really have our eye on. Also, last year in 2019, 60% of the M&A loans financed included add-back clauses. So we've got our eye on that as well. On a positive note, I mean, you can tear apart this statement and from a both a positive and a negative perspective, but firms in the S&P 500 with more cash than debt is 15% of the total. So we think those are your potential winners to focus on in this market. So I would say in conclusion, you know, as terrible as this situation is, and we're very cognizant of that, hence my opening remarks. We're thinking about all of the first responders. We're thinking about everyone with health concerns. But this too shall pass. And they're going to be winners, and they're going to be losers. I'm going to let Scott jump in with just any remarks or questions you may have. I do want to close when it's time to close the call, if you'll give me the opportunity to close with 4 points of optimism that I have. I'm getting a bit tired of hearing investment leaders jump on CNBC and contribute to the panic in the markets. I think that it is our responsibility as leaders in the investment community not to be dishonest about the situation, but not contribute to the panic. And my uncle was always really well known for calming the markets. So when it's time to conclude the call, I'd like to just add a few optimistic comments.
Terrific, thank you.
This is Scott Phillips. I'll add just a few comments. There's not much to build upon what Lauren's already said, but you know, the way we think about investing in a crisis or buying at the point of maximum pessimism kind of goes back to who we are as investors. And I think that you kind of have to look at it in a broader context of the sources of alpha and what you think your edge is as an investor. So they're basically what we understand to be three sources of alpha in the market. You can have better information than the next guy. That's basically what's going on in the trading algorithms and the high frequency trading. And that's what animates all of the research on Wall Street. Everyone's trying to get that next piece of information sooner than the other guy. That's not really our edge. We don't play there. We're, you know, long-term investors. And then the other source of alpha, you know, would be just trying to engineer a better algorithm or model or a way of looking at things that's more in the quantitative side of the industry. That too, you know, we may occasionally come across some alpha factors, but we're not spending the majority of our time thinking in those terms. And then there's the last component that's a source of alpha, and we think that's the behavioral side. That's the Ben Graham side of the equation. That's John Templeton. That's Warren Buffett. And that's really just trying to take advantage of the enormous volatility that kind of erupts out of seemingly nowhere at times, and being able to make a wise long-term purchase on that basis. So we know at our firm that a lot of our performance is really contingent upon stepping into these situations and finding bargains that can produce more extraordinary returns since they're priced at a given level. So I think that that's the one thing I would share, is that as an investor, you kind of have to sit and reflect on, well, how am I going to add value to my clients and my investment returns? And that's the way we approach it. So we really rely upon these situations in many cases.
Terrific. Well, many thanks to both of you. Scott, I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of an update or your latest views on a couple of the companies you've discussed at our online conferences in the past. I'm thinking of companies like Tyson Foods or ZQ Express, for that matter.
Yeah, so we still like both of those firms. They both have come under enormous pressure in this market, along with all the other firms. I will say on ZTO Express, you know, China recovered. Our shares in China actually recovered a lot of their ground in February. One thing we noticed with the COVID outbreak there was once the daily number of outbreaks peaked in mid-February, stocks began to recover. And so actually during February, our names like ZTO and Alibaba were positive for the month, while the rest of the global markets were really just beginning to get started in their declines. So I feel like, you know, in some ways, of course, their business was disrupted. But with China, you know, they've begun their kind of climb back into some semblance of normalization. They're, you know, a step ahead of the rest of the world. And so, you know, with the rest of the world, it seems likely to follow a similar pattern. Once you see the daily outbreaks of COVID peak and the second derivative starts to slow and come down, people will get more confident in equities. And of course, the huge question mark is when will that be? You know, will it be in a month or a year? I mean, that is, there are some pretty dire predictions out there now. We don't really subscribe to those. It's not our baseline. But, you know, you have to acknowledge the downside risk. And so in Tyson, I mean, it traded down to 7.5-8 times earnings. All of the pre-existing components to the story are still in place. You know, it still has a good balance sheet. It still has the opportunities in plant-based meats. It still has the supply disruptions going on from African swine fever in China to its benefit. And so we're, you know, very much holding that stock and adding to it as we can. I mean, the valuation is considerably lower than when we spoke, but we still like it and seeing it as an opportunity. It's definitely a longer term holding.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much for that. I'm also wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you think about portfolio management in this time, both in terms of deploying any cash and also in terms of reallocating perhaps from some companies to others.
Sure. So I think, you know, for us, we've been doing both of those things. We've actually been getting more concentrated in this sell-off. I think that that's maybe a little bit unusual, you know, for the market at large. I'm sure some of your members are probably doing the same, but, you know, why not concentrate in the best names you have as they become more, you know, more bargain price. So we're actually, you know, holding fewer names than we did going into the crisis, and we're more invested. So that may be counterintuitive to some people, but, you know, we think in this environment, we want our best players on the field, for lack of better words. We're very excited about their prospects. So in terms of actual cash management and deploying cash, we tend to average in. We don't, you know, go out and spend it all at once. Although we do recognize, just based on the last few corrections and sell-offs, you really don't have a lot of time to sit on your hands. When it comes to a high-quality name with good growth prospects, the market will come to its senses in a couple of days or a week or two. So I think, you know, in the case of adding a new position, like Amazon, we were more aggressive there. But yeah, we try to just measure our pace in. You know, going back to the 2008-2009 crisis, we really started buying in August of 2008. Mm-hmm. Lehman didn't fail until September of 2009. And then, as Lauren mentioned before, we were still buying up into early March of 2009. Excuse me, I think I said 2009 before, but yeah. September 2008, August 2008, September 2008, still buying into March of 2009. So the lesson there is that, you know, you do kind of have to pace yourself a little bit. I think what's interesting about this sell-off that wasn't necessarily the case in the 2008-2009 event was just, you know, that the way the market's changed. Lauren mentioned a number of the factors earlier with algorithms and the younger traders, but
and passive investing.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. The passive investing, I think, has made a big difference for, you know, active investors, because there's just been so much correlation. When stocks get sold, they're being sold off in baskets. And so you're getting opportunities and names that maybe shouldn't be grouped with all the other ones in the basket. Maybe the correlation isn't just. And so we think that's, you know, what was certainly happening a few weeks ago. And that's what makes kind of for, you know, a special opportunity. I don't think that used to be the case as much in the prior panics and sell-offs and bear markets. I feel like the individual names held up better. But in today's market, there's been less kind of price discovery on a stock-to-stock basis, which is very good if you're a
Can you hear us?
Yes, I hear you now. I think I lost you there for just a second.
But, yes, my father was trying to call in, so maybe he did get an iPhone after all.
Good. Well, thank you so much. I think, Lauren, we can move on to your closing remarks, please.
Okay. Yeah, just in regards to leadership and how we're all a part of this investment community, where people have, really their financial well-being at stake in the market right now. I just think it's super important not to lose sight that we're living in a period of remarkable advances in science, technology, and human achievement. Scott wrote this to an investor last week, I think, and I tweeted it this week, because I just think people need to step back, take a deep breath. We're in a bad situation now. However, he said, in the years to come, billions of people are still set to enjoy their first access to the internet, their first checking account, their first smartphone, their first purchase or payment on that smartphone, their first warm meal prepared in a few minutes, perhaps ordered from their first smartphone, a hot cup of coffee, and yes, their first flight on an airplane. And despite the near-term health concerns, scientists have not revised their views that children born today could live to be 150 years old. Many of these prospects were unimaginable in a mere 10 years ago. So that's the really long, long picture, the long-term picture. And it is optimistic. And I think we have to keep our orientation to that. When I would speak to my uncle about investing, he would often say to me, Lauren, I'm trying to figure out the best method for investing and compounding my money over the next 200 years. So when you think about long-term perspective, of course, you know, he gave the majority of his net worth to the creation of the John Templeton Foundations when he died. And he was thinking about his foundations, which is why he had this 200-year orientation. But it's very long-term. And I think, you know, in moments like these, we do have to not be so myopic. We're in a bad situation, but there will be opportunities. There will be winners. COVID-19 will come and go. And we need to be positive and not contribute to all the panic. I mean, there are some people that are locked in their homes right now that actually may be really struggling psychologically, worried about their financial net worth, worried about their health. And I just think we have a responsibility to support each other and not contribute to panic, because it's not going to help anybody.
Well, on that note, I do want to thank both of you very much for taking the time to share your perspective and your wisdom with us. And I also want to wish you and your families all the very best in this period.
Oh, you too. I'm going to need it. Homeschooling two kids now. Pray for me.
I know what that's like. We're doing the same at home.
Yes. Okay. Well, our holding and Heineken may benefit from my homeschooling efforts, but we'll see. Thank you so much for the opportunity to participate in this call.
Thank you both. Goodbye for now.
Okay. Bye-bye.